All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Yud Tet Amud Bet by the two dots. Tarabanan, Matzah Shover, they find a receipt. Bizman Shaisha Moda, when the woman admits that she actually gave the receipt, then Yachzir the Baal, you can give it back to the husband. Here it's a receipt for the payment of the Ketubah. If the woman agrees that she was paid and the receipt is valid, then we give it back to the husband. Ena Isha Moda, on the other hand, if the woman does not agree that she has been paid and the receipt is valid, Lo yachzir lo lezeh velo lezeh. We give it back to neither of the parties. Obviously, we don't give it back to the Baal because the woman doesn't agree to the fact that the receipt was given. But you also don't give it back to the woman herself so that she can't use it. But we see here that when the woman agrees that this shover is valid, that we do give it back to the Baal. The lichosh, and why don't we worry about the fact, Dilma katva litain benisam lo nad tishrei, that the receipt was actually written or predated at a much earlier time, and now she's only granting the receipt at this time. Va'azla zavanta l'ktubah b'tovat hana, and she went ahead and monetized her ktubah minisan v'tishrei, between Nisan and Tishrei. Umepik la shover, dichti benisan, he's gonna pull out the receipt from Nisan, va'ata mitrav l'kuchot shelo kidin. And then he's going to pull the plug on the buyers inappropriately. So what happens here is that she shows a receipt of payment of the ketubah. The dating on the receipt is back in Nisan. She only handed it to the husband in Tishrei. So with the dating back in Nisan, that means that the ketubah was already, quote-unquote, invalid back in Nisan because it was paid off in Nisan. Between Nisan and Tishrei, she sells the ketubah. She sells it to a third party. What we call tovat hana'ah, basically the optionality and the possibility that she will either get divorced or her husband will predecease her and therefore she'll be entitled to the ketubah. The buyer of the ketubah in that case will have the right to collect her ketubah. In the case where the husband survives her, then they won't get anything because then he inherits her and they will get nothing. So they buy it at a discounted rate. The fact is that she sold it after the ketubah was paid out already. Based on that, they have no entitlement to payment of the ketubah, and he can go back and take the property that they are collecting because of the ketubah or prevent them from collecting on the ketubah. Either way, the predating of the receipt blocks their ability to get access to any payment for the ketubah that they bought. Now, clearly, they will be entitled to a refund on their money that they paid out for the ketubah, but that's it. They won't get the full payment of the ketubah, and they'll have to deal with the woman in order to get their money back. But allowing her to utilize a shover that we find on the ground involves the same risk that we've been talking about all along in our Mishnah, which is maybe they didn't give it at the original time, they gave it at a later time, and it creates the same problem. So how can we allow this? So Amar Rava, Shma Mina Ita de Shmuel. The reason this works is because of the din of Shmuel. Damer Shmuel, a mucher shtar chuv de chaviro, someone who sells a document of indebtedness to their friend, v'chazaru mechalo, and then he goes ahead and forgives the loan, machul, it is forgiven, and the other party that bought it has no right of collection now. V'afilu yoresh mochel. And even the inheritors of the creditor have a right to be mochel. The inheritors of the creditor who have the same rights as their father have the right to be mochel on the outstanding loan. They can also forgive the loan because they inherit the same rights that their father had in this agreement, and therefore they can activate the same rights by forgiving the loan. Why you're allowed to do this or how this works, we saw this actually back in Baba Kama, Kedushin, Ketubot, shows up many times in Chas, this memory of Shmuel. The Balei Tosafot bring in those most of those occasions, as well as the Rambam, the fact that Mechirat Shtarot is only Din Drabonon. One is unable to sell a shtar mida oraita. So the ability to sell a shtar is only an institution derabonon. Since it's only an institution derabonon, your de oraita, Torah rights, never shift. Since that's the case, when the creditor sells it to whoever this third party is, they really only own the rights mida rabbanan. But that means that the de oraita, the Torah rights, remain with the creditor. And that's why the creditor here can be mochel on the loan, is because mida oraita, he's still the owner of the outstanding loan, and he has the rights to be mochel on it. That's the simplest way to explain it. In other places, the Rabbeinu Tam speaks about a duality of shibud that exists. One is a creditor, and there is a debtor. That meaning that the debtor encumbers not only his property, but he also encumbers himself to the creditor. It's what's called a shibud aguf and shibud nechasim that exist from the debtor to the creditor. When the creditor sells, he can sell the paper and the shibud nechasim. What he can't sell or what he can't regenerate is the shibud aguf. And therefore, when the creditor is mochel on the shibud aguf, along with the dissolution of the shibud aguf, is also a dissolution of the shibud nechasim, and therefore the debtor's indebtedness disappears. That's brought in the shame of the Rabbeinu Tam. Ravid says the sale of the shtar does not work at all because there's no mechanism for acquisition of a shtar. A shtar is not something that you can acquire through kinyan. The whole validity of a shtar as a kinyan is the writing of the shtar, the granting of the shtar to the party that generates the shibudim and the indebtedness that's associated with it. To simply make a kinyan on a shtar, all you have is a kinyan on the paper. You don't have a kinyan on the shtar itself at all. So the problem is the fact that the creditor doesn't have ability or rights to transfer anything to the other party. But based on the Ravid, you could suggest that if the document itself has written into it that the person who collects is the creditor or anybody coming in his name or many, basically anybody assigned the contract by the creditor, then they do have a right to collect. According to the Ravid, that would work because then embedded in the contract is the fact that there are alternative parties that could be collectors of this debt. Again, for others like the Tosafot and the Rabbeinu Tam, that may not change anything because the inability to sell the contract is the failure. For the Ravid, it's the inability to generate the connection between the debtor and the other party. But here, if you put it into the contract itself, then you can generate that relationship, and that would then overcome the problem of selling the document. But otherwise, the only party that the buyer of the contract has to go after is the malveh, not the loveh. He has no relationship with the debtor himself, according to the Ravid, and therefore you would have to go to the malveh to try to collect. And of course, according to most achronim, the only recourse over here, based on the conclusion of the Gemara, that the creditor has a right of mechila, the only recourse is to go back to the malveh and not to the loveh to get your money. And there it's not even clear what you get. I mean, that the achronim argue whether he just gets refunded what he paid for the contract, or does the malveh then on the hook for what he sold to him, which is the full value of the credit document. But either way, he won't have any recourse against the loveh because the loveh has no relationship or no indebtedness to this individual and no obligation to pay this third party. But because of that, the creditor has a right to mechila. Given that information, it doesn't really matter what the dating on the shover is, what the dating on the receipt is, because since the woman has a right as a creditor to be mochel on the outstanding obligation, that means that if she sold it in the interim and then gives him a receipt later that's predated before the actual sale of the tuba, doesn't really matter. Because at this point, even after her sale, she can forgive the obligation of the husband on the tuba. And so effectively, well, that's what she's doing. When she hands him a receipt that predates the selling of her tuba, she's basically being mochel, the obligation on the tuba. And by doing so, then their buyers have no rights of collection here vis-a-vis the tuba. Now, it's true that she, again, might have gotten money from the husband, and that's why she's giving a shover, and that would obligate her then to refund the money to those buyers because she clearly cheated them out of the ability to get that contract because of the way that it's structured here. But in terms of her ability to do such a thing and to forgive the loan, that she's empowered to do. And given that, when she gives the shover, even if it's predated, we don't worry about that. That's not an issue for us. And so therefore, if we return it to the husband, we're fine with that. And we don't worry about these other ancillary issues. So Bayamar, Bayamar says, Afilu teima leite de Shmuel. So Bayamar says, even if we don't hold of Shmuel, Hocha b'mayeskinan, b'shtar k'tuba yotza mitachat yada. It's in a case where she is in possession of the shtar k'tuba. So now, the fact that she's in possession of the shtar k'tuba casts aspersions on the buyers of the ktuba. Meaning that if the buyers really bought her ktuba, why is she still in possession of the ktuba? They should be in possession of the ktuba. Now, technically, the Rishonim point out that they don't have to be in possession of the ktuba. If she sold it to them, they have a contract saying so. But here, because of the risks, they would ensure that they have the ktuba in hand, to make sure that they could collect on it. The fact that they don't have the ketubah and she does now questions whether it was really ever sold to them. Given that, when we give back the shover, we're not necessarily damaging them because their claim is already somewhat suspect. Rav Amar, imishum shtar ketubah, chashinan l'shtei ketubot. Rav says, well, if you think that she's holding the shtar ketubah, who says they're not two outstanding documents and she has one and that they have one? Or is it a possibility that the receipt was written to offset one of them, but there's still another one that's outstanding, and maybe they do have a right of collection, or maybe we have to be choshish that she sold it. The fact that she has a document doesn't prove to us that she didn't sell her ketubah to another party, and that was the other version of the ketubah, or another documentation of her ketubah. It sounds like here that it's a duplication. I mean, that she said she lost it, and then she found it, whatever it is. But it could be the way that you're describing also, which is that it's a separate obligation. Either way, you have the same problem, which is that if there's an outstanding ketubah that she has sold, then this receipt is going to block the ability to collect it. The shover, the receipt is written stam, that the ketubah was paid. It doesn't say maybe the amount, doesn't say the any other information. So that shover will work to knock out any ketubah that is brought because of the way that it's written. It's written in a generic way. No matter what the scenario is, whether it's actually a duplication of the original ketubah or an additional ketubah or hitchayvut, obligation, either way, the receipt will knock it off. And because of that, you'd worry about the fact that she did sell it, and the shover will undermine that. Rabbi Amar, chado, first of all, the shtei ketubot lo chashinan. Let's start with that. We don't worry about two ketubot. That's an unusual situation, and also an unlikely situation. The husband is not going to write two ketubot, because it's a huge risk to him of double collection. And if he writes the other ketubah, it will be written on it that it supersedes their first ketubah. But the fact that we're going to worry about this, that's far-fetched. So Bayez says we're not going to worry about that. Two ketubot is very far-fetched. Unusual situation. Va'od, shover bizmano tarif. So now Bayez also says, a shover, based on its date, creates the ability to take or to block. Which is Abaye l'tame, Abaye l'shitato, that Amar edav bechatumav zachinlo. That with the signature on the document, that is what generates the obligation. So if you remember, we saw this Abaye earlier on when he was describing the ability of a lien to come into effect as to why he didn't worry about the fact that if we gave back a shtar that is dated to a much earlier date, why do we not worry about that? Doesn't that make his lien precede the lien of the other parties? He said, no problem, because the lien was generated at the time that the edim sign on the document. As soon as they sign on the document, that generates the lien. Now, if you remember there, that Abaye says is that there is a condition in that, that it's actually given. That the document actually has to be given to the party that the document is written to in order to trigger the lien, but the lien is triggered retroactively. And that's the same thing. You can see in Rashi, it says the same thing here by the shover. The shover was signed at a much earlier date, and now she hands it. His right of, quote-unquote, collection, or his right of lien, then really starts from the time of the signatories to the shover. But once he receives the shover, that triggers it retroactively. And that's what Rashi says, Zochel mafreya bo mizman chatimato. Retroactively, he will get the right of collection based on that shover. Now, here it's a little different than a contract where the possibility that they can go after the property as a lien, or there's some sort of recourse built into it. Here, the idea is that if the lekuchot, the buyers of the ketubah, came and took her property that belonged to the ketubah, or did something to collect on the ketubah, that he has a right now to go take it back from them, because his rights preceded their rights. He has a document that says the ketubah was already discharged, already way back, based on the date. But according to Abaye and Abaye the Shitato, that dating is what creates the zman hapiron, in essence. And it's basically a receipt that is backdated, but a receipt that is backdated is valid as long as the edim signed at the time that the date says on it. And as soon as they signed at the time the date goes on it, that makes it a valid receipt. And as long as he is in possession of the receipt, he got the receipt at some point in time, that is sufficient grounds to give him the first rights here, or basically to say that the ketubah was paid at the date that is written in the shover, and therefore we don't worry about it. So that's a biased solution to the problem. Biased solution to the problem makes it that we don't have to invoke Shmuel's principle. Rava says we do invoke Shmuel's principle in order to allow this to happen. generally machloket Rav and Abaye, the halacha is like Rava, which would also support the fact that the halacha here is like Shmuel, that you do have a right of mechila. Now, Tosfot over here asks a question, which is that Chazal have a form of kinyan called Bamamad Shloshtan. It's a form of kinyan where if all three parties are present at the kinyan, then you can generate a kinyan. It was put in place for business transactions to facilitate liquidity in the market for business transactions where you have a buyer, seller, and some credit extender that are all together in the store or in a wholesale place and they want to create the transaction. The problem is that they are lacking in kinyan, or how do they transfer over the debts? How do they move things around? Basically, how do they endorse a check and give it to the other person? It's similar conceptually to moving along IOUs from one party to the other. They all parties want to do it, but they need a legal kinyan in order to execute on this type of transaction. So Chazal talk about something called mamad shlushtam, which is the ability in the presence of all three parties to generate such a kinyan. That's what Tosfot asks over here. In Shmuel Shita, why don't we worry about this? That type of kinyan is a strong enough kinyan that it overrides any other rights that are here. Meaning that whether you believe that that's a din d'oraita or more likely a din d'rabbanan, the rabbanan created this kinyan in order to facilitate liquidity in the market, facilitate business transactions, and that supersedes any other rights. It blocks her right to be mochel on the outstanding document or ketubah that she has on the credit that she is owed. So now, Tosfot says, how can you return the shover? Because maybe she sold it, b'mamad shloshtam, and in selling it, b'mamad shloshtam, she has no right of mechila anymore. And then according to Rava, what's the right to give it back? For Abai, it doesn't matter, because he doesn't need Shmuel to do it. But for Rava, that's a problem. So he says, v'yesh lamar, d'leka l'mecha, shema machra b'mamad shloshtam, d'yeleka edim shemachra, habal v'aisha, yichafru b'mechira. That is because if there are no edim to testify to the fact that this transaction happened, both the husband and the wife will deny it. And if there are edim, we can ask them when it happened. The mamad shloshtam is what gives you the gmir tadat to generate the kinyan. Now you need some sort of documentation or witnessing to the mamad shloshtam. So you have to document the fact that it happened or witnesses to the fact that it happened. If you don't have witnesses, then the husband and wife can deny it because they don't have any evidence of the fact that it ever took place. If you have edim, then you can ask the edim when it happened. So Tosfot says you can avoid the problem of mamad shloshtam because there you will need evidence to the fact that it took place. Ve'od yesh lemar, d'lo tiknu mamad shloshtam, ela b'davar ha-ra'oy l'gavot miyad. And then he brings a second issue or qualification of mamad shloshtam, which is mamad shloshtam is only applicable when the credit is collectible immediately. So again, that would be equivalent of a check. So you've written a check to one party, and now the person, instead of cashing the check, the IOU wants to pass it to another business owner in order to buy something, not to avoid taxes, just simply to move the credit along. So in that case, it is immediately collectible, meaning that IOU, that check can be cashed by any party along the way. That is where Tosfot says the mamad shloshtam was instituted. It wasn't instituted for future collections, for optionality in buying credit documents or ketubot in the future. So mamad shloshtam is not effective over here. Aval b'ketubah deinu chayav ata ad achar gerushin, by the ketubah, which is not immediately collectible, but only in the future after there's a divorce, v'gam Hashem lo tidgaresh, lo tiknu mamad shloshtam. There, mamad shloshtam is not applicable. Now, Tosfot says, well then, why don't we worry about the fact that she sold it after she got divorced? I mean, once she's divorced, the ketubah is immediately collectible. And then she could sell it by mamad shloshtam, and then we find this shover, we find this receipt, and the receipt is predated the sale. But there she would have the ability to sell it, by mamad shloshtam, after it's already collectible. So Tosfot says about that, we don't worry about that. Shema machra chere gushim mamad shloshtam, ki achar gerushim istama machra bedamim yekarim. First of all, if she sold it after she's already divorced, it's immediately collectible. Meaning that the risk that you discount the document for is all gone. The whole reason you discount the value of the ketubah is that there is possibilities. She will or will not get divorced. She will or will not predecease her husband. That optionality is what creates the discount. if she's already divorced and the ketubah is immediately collectible, she's basically going to get paid in full or close to full. So for there, kishayotzia baal shuvro shekadam hitzricha l'shalem v'lo tarviya klum biknunya. There's not enough profit here for her to collude with the husband in order to predate the shover. It doesn't do anything for her. The differential between the actual ketubah and what she sold it for is so small that it doesn't pay for her to create a collusion to save that small amount of money. When you're talking about selling it way before the events happen, there you have a serious discount to the document, and that differential is worth her colluding with the husband or the ex-husband in order to make up that differential. She only collected a small amount compared to what the full value of the ketubah is. And therefore, Tosfot says, Lo chashinan el shama machra ba'udo tachtav b'tovat ana'a, shehi davar mu'at. There, if she colludes with the husband in order to get the differential back, that's a serious amount of money. And that differential is worth colluding about because she could split it with the husband, she could do whatever. It pays off for her to do that. That's what Tosfot's pointing out. That the reason that we worry about collusion at the earlier time is because of the discount in the value. That's why she would do things to undermine the sale. But when the sale is done post her divorce, her discount is so small, it's not worth the collusion. It's just not worth it for her. So that's the first thing that Tosfot deals with. The second thing that Tosfot deals with is shover bizmano tarif. Now, he says something here which is obvious from the case, but has implications. And he says, afo pi shishtar mechira nimsa l'luchuchot tchila inu mo'il. The case here is that she sold her ketubah, and then the shover was given to the husband. The receipt was given to the husband. That means that the kuchot got their document before the husband got his document. Nevertheless, since the shover, the receipt was signed prior, even though it's only given to him after other transactions happened, l'mafreya, retroactively, he has a right to supersede anything that happened after the signing of the shover. So Tosfot points out here, it's not only about the fact that the document was signed before and then had to be given before the other documents are given. Even if it's given after the other documents are signed or the sales that happen, nevertheless, this mafreya, this retroactivity, allows you to then supersede even though you only got possession of the shover at a later date. So he says it's only dependent on the time of signing, not on the time when it actually got into the hands of the baal. As long as it gets into the hands of the baal, no matter when, it has this automatic retroactivity that will give it the dating of the time that it was signed. That's important because you could have thought that he only has rights of retroactivity based on when he receives it. As long as he received the document before the buyers received their document. Because then it would have been in effect beforehand. The answer is that even if she sells it in the interim, the effective date retroactively goes into effect as soon as he receives it, even if he receives it after they have received their documents. And that does what points out. He spends time on explaining how that works or why there are differences between here and other places in Shas. But it's important to know that because it has nafkaminot that you can create a retroactive effective date, even though the document only reaches the intended party at a much later date after many other transactions are done. And the documentation and the contracts have been given to those parties, this retroactivity still works, even though you got the document at a much later time. Now Tosfot says here, Vinire, and he says, Shetakanat chachamim hi, shezuche mishat chatima, avu pi shelo nimsar lo ad yamim rabim achrei kein. He thinks that it's a takanat chachamim, that this works, this retroactivity works, even though he came into possession of the document at a much later date. Shemekei lo kein, lo olam lo yuchlu aidim lachtom, elo yim yiru ha-misira. Because otherwise then you create a bind for the Edim. How can the Edim sign on a document if they don't know for certain that it's being given today? You can never have Edim sign on a document unless they actually witness the giving of the document and they're not going to sign. Because then the Edim, anytime they sign, would have to worry about the fact that it wasn't given at that moment or not given before other contracts went down. So Tosfot says the Chachamim instituted that as soon as they sign on it, when it's given at the later date, that's the effective date, no matter what. L'inyan isur. Nira, David Baal Bat Yisrael, kodem shebal yado get shichrur, shepasla. Well, now, you actually have, based on this institution, the possibility of generating a get l'mafreya, which is that you can write a get, have it dated, and then only give the get at a later time. That's both for a get isha, or a get shichrur for an eved knani. The case that Tosfot speaks about here is that an Eved Knani has a tryst with a Bat Yisrael. He would have been posla her because he was still an Eved Knani. But the Adon's Shtar Shichrur is dated before the event. So now when he gives it to him after the event, retroactively, he was a Ben Yisrael. He was not a Pasul when they had this tryst. And that would actually remove the Isur over here. So Tosfot says over there, I don't know if that really works because by Isur, they might not have instituted their position, but rather only by Mimonot in monetary matters. But then he said something even bigger. V'shema gabi Isur zochin lo mishat chachatima. Afobi delo shaykh tama deprishit. Even though the reasoning that I gave doesn't matter over here, which is, we're worried about signatories and the problems of predating. That's only true by monetary contracts. It's not true by issues of Isur. Mikom makom lo polug rabbanon. The rabbanon didn't make a difference. V'yesh koach v'yad chachamim lakar davar min haTorah. This is Tosafot l'shitato, who believes that even not in cases of sheo v'al taseh, in cases where the chachamim want to and feel there's a tremendous necessity, they mi'okir davar min haTorah, especially by the case of Eid Echad. By an aguna, that's what Tosfot says is the mechanism that allows the woman to get married, despite the fact that we only have one aid, and it's din arayot. The Ramban and the other Rishonim argue vehemently against that Balei Tosfot, and say that it's doraita, that they're nemanim, but the Balei Tosfot over there believe that b'tzorech gadol, in a narrow scopes, the Chachamim have a right to be oker b'kum v'asei din Torah. And here you see the same thing, Tosfot suggesting something along those lines, that this retroactivity, even though it's derabbanan, will be allowed to work even in Isur. For low plug. That's interesting. Tos originally said, let's differentiate between Mamon and Isur. And they said, we have to create low plug, because otherwise the reason they might have to do that is otherwise the takana doesn't stand. I mean that if you create this difference between different contracts, people will discount what the Chachamim are saying, because they don't believe it's really true. If you say it applies to all contracts, then they'll abide by it, because they think it's a general rule that applies by everything. If you start cherry pick, it only applies to this contract. At that contract, people start to not take it seriously. Although I think I would agree here that Tosfot doesn't have a strong leg to stand on to say they're going to be oker davar min haTorah just for this low plug over here. It's this interesting speculation. But then he asks, v'im tomar, this is some along the ways of your question, which is, v'abai sabar k'rabbi alozo damar idei misira karte. Wait a minute. Doesn't Abaye subscribe to Rabbi Elazar's position that Ede Mesira Akarti? That means that the effectiveness of the document has nothing to do with the signatories, but everything to do with when the document was given, the witnessing of the Mesira itself. If that's the case, then what happens over here? Then you have a problem because the Mesira could take place at a later date, and the signing could be at an earlier date. And now you run into a bind, which is that how can you create an effective date of when it was signed if the actual execution only takes place when you have the Eidei Mesira involved in the situation. Then does what writes in the end. Aval, Ein Zmanam Shaver, if you have documents that do not have the same dating in them, HaChatum Kodem Zacha, Afal Pisha Mu'uchar Nimsar Tchila. Tosfot in the end basically says that the signatories create a effective date, even though the Eidei Mesira only witness it later. So that the Mesira is what generates the execution of the actual document, but its effective date is based on the signatories to the document, which is amazing, which is that the Eidei Mesira, yes, are the ones that, quote-unquote, generate the obligations or generate the actual divorce, we'll call it, or freeing of the slave, but the document's validity is determined by the date inside of it and the effective date inside of it. And that means that if you date something earlier, and the Mesira for this later document happens first, that doesn't help you. That the Eidei Mesira, the second document, do not make the effective date earlier. And what Tosfot is pointing out here, it's a big chiddush, is the fact that the effective date is the determinant of when the transaction is actually completed or the action took place, even though the Mesira took place at a much later time, after the Mesira of later dated Shtarot. And therefore, Mesira is not the determinant of the effective date. It is actually the date in the shtar when the Edim signed on the shtar. So it's amazing that that retroactivity is so strong that it supersedes the actual Mesira and the Edim Mesira, who are the ones that generate the effectiveness of the contract or the effectiveness of the get. Nevertheless, the dating of the shtar and those that signed in it create the dating vis-a-vis the competition with other shtarot. It's an amazing statement that Tosfot makes over here. Big chiddush in Tosfot. It's important in general to understand both by the shita of Rabbi Elazar and the shita of Rabbi Meir. When we say either Edim Sira Karte or either Chatima Karte, what does that mean? Meaning that in terms of a divorce that takes place, what is the effective date of the divorce? And here you have a chiddush in Tosfot that even according to Abai in the shita of Rabbi Elazar, even though Edim Sira Karte, the Chatima, the signatories to the document actually create the effective date, even though the action, the Kinyan, is only executed or done with the Edim Mesira that actually witnessed the event that takes place. And the same you would have to say in terms of Rabbi Meir in reverse, which is Rabbi Meir who believes that the signatories to the get create the effectiveness of the get. He would say the same thing or something similar, which is that the get, once it's given to the woman, that the effective date of the get is actually the date that the signatory signed on the get, and not necessarily the time that it was given over. It has to be given to the woman. That's a condition in the get for Rabbi Meir. But once it's given, the effective date is then the date. That means that what Tosfot just did was made Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar the same, according to Abaye. Because in the end, you need to have a mesira for the get to be effective. The woman needs to receive the get. It's not a get till she receives it. That's a requirement in the Torah. But the effective date now, according to both Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Meir, will be the dating of the shtar. The only difference between them might be that for Rabbi Meir, you won't need witnesses to the Mesira, whereas for Rabbi Elazar, you will need witnesses to the Mesira to make it effective. But the effective date now, according to both of them, will be the date in the document. It actually narrows the scope of the machloka, according to Abai, between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Meir. Next Mishnah. Matzai gerot shum v'igrot mazon, shtarei chalitza u'miyunin, u'shtarei birurim, v'chol ma'asei beitin, or zeh ma'yachzir. So over here you have a list of documents, which are documents that are created by a Beit Din. They are basically actions of a Beit Din. They are not contracts or agreements between parties. So in this case, you have very little risk in terms of returning them, because this whole idea or the worry that we have is that maybe a person wrote them and then decided to change their mind and not give the document. None of that is relevant when you're speaking about a Beit Din. A Beit Din, once you have an executed document, we know that it actually happened, or the fact that the document exists already is evidence of the fact that it happened. So to return it is not a problem at all. The nature of the documents here, igrot shum, are assessment documents. It's where Beit Din assess the property or assess the value of a seizure, and they're giving that value in order for the person to collect whatever outstanding debts that they have or outstanding rights that they want to execute. Here, Beit Din has determined the value of the property that they are going to seize, or they are giving their value assessment before it goes to auction to give a benchmark against where the auction should come out or seek the money that they should get through the auction. Vigrot mazon. Over here, this could be either Rashi claims vigrot mazon, shekibalav lazon et bat ishto. It's a case where the husband agreed to take care of his stepdaughter in the marriage, and he agrees to give her mizonot for a fixed period of time. Others say igrot mazon are the right of the women and the daughters to collect their mizonot from the estate where the father or husband passed away, or in a case where he's a recalcitrant husband and he's not giving mizonot to the woman, it's Beit Din's seizure of the property in order to feed the mazon. Shterei chalitza, so obviously if you have a yavam and yavama who don't want to get married, and they get a chalitza through Beit Din, this is a maisa Beit Din. This is only something that happens inside of Beit Din. Mi'unin also are something, documentation of the fact that a young girl who is underage, who is married off by her brother or mother, she is orphaned in the lifetime of her father, toma b'chaye avia, or she really is an orphan. In either case, the father is the only one midoraita that has a right to give her over b'kiddushin while she's a ktana. If her father has already passed away or has been effectively eliminated from the scenario, he already married her off once, whatever reason that he doesn't have a right to do this again, then if the mother or brother marry her off and they create a marriage midrabanan, that marriage can be dissolved midrabanan with something called miyun. So the shtari miyun is just evidence of the fact that this girl rejected basically the marriage or annulled the marriage. Shtari berurin. The Gemara will discuss what exactly Shtari Berurim is, but it's something that is dealing with two parties or clarifying something about two parties. Chomase Beit Din, any action Beit Din, Yachzir. Matzah bechafisa o belus guma. If he finds them in these utensils or some sort of holders, or tachrich shtel shtarot, or agudah shel shtarot, a wrap of shtarot, or a bundle of shtarot, or zeh yachzir, you return them. The Gemara will discuss each one of these and describe what they are in more detail. Kamo agudah shel shtarot, what is considered to be a bundle of shtarot, shlosha kshrim zeh bezeh, three that are tied together. Shem Gamliel Omer, echad aloveh mishlosha, if you have three documents that are together, and it's got the same debtor in the documents, but three different creditors, yachzir l'loveh. You give it back to the debtor. It's obvious that the documents are together because it's coming from or dropped by a single person who is the debtor over here. Shlosha lavim min achad. On the other hand, if the creditor is the same, but three different debtors, then yachzir l'malveh. You can give it back to the malveh. Because what are these documents doing together? Elim Cain, they were in the hands of the malveh or in the hands of the loveh in each of these scenarios. If he has a shtar amongst his shtarot. Now here, many believe that this is talking about a shlish. This is talking about an independent third party. And he finds a shtar amongst his shtarot. And he doesn't know what the nature of the shtar is. Was it paid? Was it not paid? That's left until Eliyahu comes, so we can't determine. If there is a simpon with it. A simpon, Rashi says this here, says in other places in Shas, a simpon is anything that nullifies or ruins any transaction or any obligation. So for instance, the word simpon is used by a woman. Simpon is the chashash, possibly that she has mumim, that the husband will find out about, and that will dissolve the marriage because it's considered to be a mekach ta'ut. So the mumim are called simpon because they have the ability to dissolve the marriage or annul the marriage. So too over here. It's called a simpon because a simpon is a receipt that would annul the contract or the obligations that are here. Now, the difference between a simpon and a shover, Tosfos says later on in the Gemara that a shover is a receipt held by the loveh, by the debtor. A simpon is a receipt held by the malveh. The malveh is holding a receipt that says the document was paid. So the difference in the names is depending on who's holding it. They're the same thing. It's a receipt. If the loveh is holding it, the debtor's holding it, then it's called a shover. If the creditor's holding it, then it's called a simpon. So if he finds the simpon together with this shtar, yaseh ma shebisimponot, then he does whatever is written in the receipt. He has to abide by that because he doesn't know better. And if he doesn't know better, then the simpon governs over here. And that will annul whatever obligations it says it annuls in the contract. So again, it depends on whether this is a shlish. Some say it's even the malveh. If it's in the malveh, it's amongst his documents. That's the question here. But either way, the context helps you a little bit, which is that if it's found with documents we're going to see later on in the Gemara that look like they're paid or have a sense that they're not in the front burner anymore, that would indicate that the document's probably already paid or it's not collectible. And if it's found in his active documents, that would mean something else. And here again, when it's found with simponot, that has implications. The context in which it's found also has implications about the validity of the contract. So now, Gemara says, "My shtare berurin." What exactly are these shtare berurin? Hacha targumo. Over here they explained it, they translated it. Remember, you're talking about a Mishnah that's written in Hebrew, that is a Lashon in Eretz Yisrael. And here you're talking about a Gemara that's trying to translate that into Aramaic or into what does it mean here in Bavel. So Hagatargamo Shtarei Tanato. One option was that these are documents of claims, which is basically it's the documentation of the claims of the two parties in the case so that we can see if they perjure themselves. I mean, if they change their story all of a sudden, or they start to add in claims that they didn't have before. Here we have a documentation of exactly what the claims were when the case closed. And therefore, we can make a decision based on that. We don't have to then find them or have them come back and testify again. Or if they change their mind, we know that they've changed their mind. Rabbi Yiri Amar, Zebor lo echad, Zebor lo echad. It's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that says that when you come to a quote-unquote court case that has to be decided and you need three judges, one party picks one judge, one party picks the other judge, and the two judges pick the third judge. So that way we get an impartial Beit Din in that case. The acceptance of a judge as being your choice, this is a shtar that documents that you've chosen that and you can't back out of that choice anymore. And that's what a shtari berurin is. Again, in all these cases, these are documents of Beit Din, and therefore we don't have to worry about the fact that somebody changed their mind over here. Right? B'chol ma'aseh Beit Din or is a yachzir. How Gita, this is a case we just saw in the Gemara back in Daf Yud Chet. It's an identical story with Rabba and Rav Huna and Rav Chista. How gita nishtakach beidina de Rav Huna? There was a get found on the floor in the beidina Rav Huna. Davaktiv be b'shvirei mato darakis nara. That it's in this location of shvirei that resides on the banks of the river. Rav Huna, whose beitin it was, says, Cheshinan l'shnei shvirei. We worry about the fact that maybe there's another place called shvirei. So even though from the location that's mentioned here, there is only one Yosef ben Shimon there. We don't know of any other person with that same name. And even though we don't know of another city with that name, we're choshesh for the fact maybe there's another city like that who has someone, Yosef ben Shimon, on there, and it's their document and not the document of the claimant over here who's saying that he dropped the document or he lost the document. That was Rav Huna's claim. Once again, Rashi over here says, you look in Rashi, he says, Mikuyam behenpek. This is a document that is validated by the Beit Din. So it's a bill of divorce validated by the Beit Din. The Shliach says it fell from him. If you remember back on Daf Yud Chet, Tosafot rejected that understanding of Rashi, because he says if it's in the hands of the Shliach, Beit Din's not validating it. Beit Din won't validate it unless the woman's divorced. If the Shliach still has it, the woman was never divorced. And therefore, Bali and Tosafot say that the case is either it was a Shliach who lost it, or it's the woman who lost it and it's validated by Beit Din. The two are mutually exclusive. It can't be that there's a Shliach with a validated get, because a shliach with a validated get means that the get already got to the woman, and what's the shliach doing with it, not the woman. And if the woman has it and it's validated, that means that the shliach has no shaychut anymore to this get. Based on that, Tosfot says the two scenarios were either it was a shliach, and we said over there the reason that we don't worry about any issues is because a baal cannot renege the shlichut, that was one of the takanot we had back in the Gemara Gittin, or if it's validated by Beit Din, then also we don't worry about it because it definitely happened and Beit Din validated it. But Rashi, again, brings the two issues together, and Tosfot rejects that connection of a henpek to the shliach. Amalei Rav Chista, the rabbah, pok ayin. Go look into the matter. De la orta baila Rav Huna minach. Rav Huna tonight is going to ask you about this issue, so go make sure that you look into the issue so you have an answer for him. Nafak dak vashkach, he went out and he found it's none. A mishnah called maseh beit din, or he's a yachzir. Any action of Beit Din that needs to be returned, that's our Mishnah. That's the line in the middle of our Mishnah, that any Maisa Beit Din goes back. And here you have a Maisa Beit Din because either you have a henpek on the document, or you have a shliach whose shlichut cannot be reneged. Amalei Rav Amram the Rabbah, Heichin Pashin Mari Surah Mimamona. How is it possible that you're trying to bring a proof to Isur, which is get, from something that's dealing with mimonot, with monetary issues? Tosfot over here discusses whether it's such a good claim at all. Because we find many things by documentation where we have a higher threshold or a higher standard by mamononot than we have by isur. So why is it that it's even a logical argument? Because maybe mamononot is more chamor. And you could learn from mamononot to isur. So Tosfot in the end says that maybe because over here we're dealing with eshet ish hechmiru, or because we're not chayish for shnei Yosef and Shimon by regular monetary documents, by gitin, m'chashinon, mishum laz, v'mono lo shaykh laz, over there we don't worry about rumors circulating about this woman or about this situation, so you won't have that problem. So he says that the scenario must be a scenario where it makes sense to say the isur is more chamor than a mamon. And so Rav Amram's question is, we have our Mishnah, our Mishnah is dealing with documents that are monetary in nature, how can you prove anything to isur in that case? Amalei tardo. Alright, so now, this word is translated by Rashi numerous places in Shas. We actually just saw one in Baba Kama. You can see that over here, that they referenced to Baba Kama over there. Rashi in Baba Kama says, chaser lev. You're missing a heart. You have no heart. That's the way Rashi translates it there. Over there, the word is tadura, more than tarda. Rashi here translates it as mishumam. Mishumam, not in the modern day meaning, but rather mishuga. You're crazy. Rashi in other places brings additional aspects to that mishumam, more detailed descriptions about maligning the individual asked the question, basically saying, you don't know what you're talking about. What type of question is this? Rejecting it out of hand by saying that you don't know what you're talking about. You lack a heart. You lack any knowledge. You lack the ability to think. You're crazy. All these different definitions that are brought by the Rishonim, as well as tarda, or the word tered, is used in the Gemara to refer to it. Sometimes, but it's a beet or spinach, but it also might be referencing to that. Like you're just like a vegetable, but in a sense that you don't know how to think. Definitely a negative connotation to it. Shtarei chalitza mi'unim tanan. Did you look at the Mishnah? The Mishnah has a list of documents. In those documents include chalitza and mi'un, which are dine isur, or isurim, and isurim that deal with eshadish. So it's clear there that the Mishnah is not just talking about mamona, no, it's talking about isurim as well. So, paka arza, the beirav, the erez from the cedar. In those days, to create large beams, you had to cut a tree at a very large cedar beam. Those were known as the korot. They could either be the cross beams that were structurally supportive of the roof or the top, or they were also the upright beams that held up the roof or the Beit Midrash. So it says here that the upright beam, that's what Rashi says, broke or cracked in the Beit Midrash. Mar amar mishum latai didi, paka. One of them said it was for my honor that it broke. Mar amar mishum latai didi, paka. For my honor it broke. Rabba said it was in my honor it broke because you embarrassed me in front of the Beit Midrash and questioned my proof in front of the Beit Midrash, and therefore it broke in my honor to show how upset they were upstairs about the fact that you embarrassed me. And Rav Amram said, no, that it broke in my honor because you denigrated me in front of everyone and called me a tarda. And therefore, out of my honor, it cracked. So each one took credit for the fact that it cracked in their honor. So now the Gemara continues. Matzah bechafisa obdoluskuma. That we said in the Gemara, it's found in some sort of utensil. What are these? My chafisa. What is this chafisa? Amar Rabba Bar Chana, chemat ktana. Talking about a small flask in which they've stuffed in these shtarot to keep them in there. My deluskuma. Let's say deluskuma amar Rabba Bar Shmuel, tlika de sabe. It is the pouch of the elderly. So it's some sort of satchel that they wore. They used to give them to people who are more advanced in age because they tended to lose things. This was their secure, safe place where they deposited anything that they wanted to know where it was. They kept it on them or they put it there. Now, whether they wore it or they kept it in a specific location, for them it was an easy place because if they put everything there, they knew where to find it when they came back again. So if you find it in these utensils, then you have an ability to have a siman. What you say is you announce matzah shtarot. We found documents, and the person wants to give a siman will tell you what the documents were found in. And by doing that, then they have an ability to get it back. Tachrich shel shtarot or gadol shel shtarot. Tanabanan, kamu tachrich shel shtarot. How many is a roll of shtarot? Shlosha, kuchim zebazet. Three rolled together. Bekami agudah shel shtarot. Well, it's an agudah shtarot. Shlosha kshrim zebazet. Three tied together. So three rolled together is considered to be a tachrich of shtarot. Three tied together is considered to be an agudah, a bundle of shtarot. Shvamina, kesher siman. From that, you would conclude that a knot, or the way that it's knotted, is a siman. Because otherwise, what is the siman over here when you have an agudah of shtarot? The fact that you have a kuchin zebzeh, that by itself is already a siman. Because that tells you how they were put together, what they were put together as. That's a siman. But over here, if you tie them, everybody ties the shtarot together. So then why is there a siman through the kesher? That means that the knot itself is a siman. It's a question that will come up in the Gemara in Ela Metziot as whether kesher is a siman or not. And we can conclude from here, maybe it is. It says, Atani Rabbi Chia, Shlosha Kuchim Zebezeh. He says that an agudav shtarot is three rolled together. It says, Yochi Anu Tachrich. Then what's the difference between three rolled together and three rolled together? I mean that you're giving the same definition to both of them. So tachrit kol chad achad v'roshad d'chavrei. A tachrit kev shtarot is a case where you start to roll one. Before you finish rolling the first one, you enter the second one, and then you continue on. And then the third one you enter before you finish rolling the third one. You're rolling them together that way. Agudah durama adadi v'kruchot. The way that an agudah is that you lay all three of them on top of each other and you roll them together. So in parallel, they're rolled together completely. At the same time, you roll all three of them together, and that'll be the difference between them. So now, my machris. So now, what do you announce? What is exactly the siman that you're looking for when you announce? These are like two standard methods of rolling, so why is that not? So my machris minyan. You announce the number. Gemara says, my arya tzlata afilu trein nami. Then why does the Mishnah say only by three you announce it, not by two? Why should it make a difference? If you're announcing the number, then it shouldn't matter. If what you're saying is correct, that the method of rolling is the siman, then you announce the number. Why should it matter if it's two, three, four, whatever the number is, announce it. Why is there a minimum of three? Because I'm a Ravina, Tavva Machris. You announce what you found. Just like over there in Ela Metziot, Ravina says, you announce, I found coins, and the number of coins is the Siman, Hachanami Shtari Machris. So Doriri just announced, I found documents. The number of shtarot will be the evidence or the siman that you give in order to get it back. So when he says that, he generically says, I found documents. When he generally says this, they've got to come back with the number. The problem with two is, and this is not so simple because it's not obvious, but he says that two is a problem because a minimum of plurality is two. So if you announce I have documents, the guy can guess two, and if it really is two, you might be right. But once you get up to three, you're away from that minimum number, and therefore when he announces I found documents, then you have to come up with the real number in order to be right. As Rashi, I know it over here, says, Hilkok dafka tzlata, but shrei medi yadiyah demiyot shterot shtayim, ve'im inyan siman. The problem is that even if you say that there are two, when he announced documents, how does the guy know that it's the minimum to guess that it is two? So even with two, Rashi says two, you couldn't do because it'd be too obvious. But why is it so obvious? When he announced documents, it's not clear that he has the minimum amount. He has three or four. It's not clear what he has. It should be the same safek as when you have three. Elim Ken, you say if you were a guessing person and you said documents, two would be the number more often than not. And therefore, we don't want to take that risk. You have to say something along those. Again, it's not clear to me how the people who are coming to give the siman know that it's two. And again, you say the probabilities are highest that it's two, and therefore it's not a good siman because people could guess that and maybe get it anyway. Shimon Gamliel Omer, Chadalove Mishlosha Yachzir Lelove. Disa Kadatcha Demalvin Nihu. If you think they belong to the creditors, Ma Bai Gabe Hadodi. Why are they all together? I mean, you have three separate creditors and one debtor in the documents. Then what are the documents doing together? Elohim Kane, they fell from the debtor. Why should they have fallen together if there were three different creditors involved? It says, Dilma, the Kuminhu Azle. So the Gemara says, maybe somebody was taking them to the Beit Din to get them validated. So these were three different creditors, and they gave them to the Sofer, to a Shliach, to go get them validated in Beit Din. It says, the Mikaime, they already had a Kum Beit Din in them. They were already validated, so that can't be the case. Dilma, Miyodah the Safra Nafil. Maybe they fail out of the hands of the Sofer. The way the Gemara is saying them, they were already validated. So that if they're already validated and the Sofer has them, that means that he's already gone to Beit Din, he's bringing them back, and then he dropped them, all these three contracts that were validated. It says, Lom Shayinish, Kiume, be under the Safra. Person doesn't leave his validated document in the hands of the Sofer, he gets on his hands on it right away, because it's important for him to have the document. He's not going to just leave it hanging around with the Sofer. So you're not going to worry about it being dropped from the Sofer, and you have three different creditors that all gave it to the Sofer to go get it validated. So we're not choshish for that. Again, if it's three debtors, but a single creditor on the documents. If you think they belong to the debtors, why are they all with this one creditor if they're different debtors? So the Gemara says, maybe they went to have them documented. Here's a case where maybe the debtors were getting them documented, and the Sofer was writing it for these debtors, and then was going to give it to the Malveh on behalf of the debtors. It says, Echtiv Tlat Yadei Safre. Three different handwritings in them, so that can't be the evidence now. It can't be that one Sofer wrote them and dropped them on the way to giving them to the debtors, because they're in three different handwritings, which means that the only connecting point between these documents is the Malveh, the creditor. The Dilma the Kimyuno Azle. Again, maybe they're going to get validated in Beit Din. Malve Mikhaim Shtare, Love Lo Mikhaim Shtare. That's not a problem, because the only one who wants a validated document is the creditor. The debtor has no interest in a validated document, because that just makes his situation worse. That means that he's going to have to pay for sure. So he's better off not validating the document to be Choshesh, that they were on the way to Beit Din for the debtors to have their documents validated. That's a far-fetched or almost impossible case to happen, because they have no interest in the validation of the documents. All right. If they have receipts with them, he does what's in the receipts. Amarav Yemri Abav Amarav. Simpona yotzei mitachet yidei malveh. If you have a simpon that comes from the hand of the malveh, afopi shekatuv biktav yado. Even if it's his handwriting, enu elak misacheku pasul. He was playing games with the debtor, and it's pasul. As long as the malveh is in possession of the simpon, we just assume he wrote it, thinking that he might give it, or making the debtor feel like he might give it, but he never gave it. Clearly, where it's written in the handwriting of a third party, there we will say it's invalid. Safra itramile vikotov. He found a sofer. He doesn't have the ability to write. So he wanted to have a receipt in hand, because when the debtor shows up with the money, He wants to be able to get the money immediately. Because if he doesn't have a receipt, the debtor is not going to give him the money. So he wants a receipt on file so that immediately when the debtor shows up, he can give it to him. And since he can't write it, he gets the sofer to write it ahead of time. So clearly, if it's written in the sofer's handwriting, it has validity because of the fact that he might have kept it around in order to have it handy when the debtor shows up. Ela afilu katuv biktav yado. Even if we know he knows how to write, because it's written in his handwriting, it's still pasul. Savar dilmamit rami v'ati benishmashot v'kaparli. The problem is that maybe the debtor will show up late on Friday afternoon with the money, benishmashot. Smart debtor. He shows up with his money, benishmashot, and says, "All right, I have the money now. Do you have a receipt?" And the guy doesn't know how to write, so he has to get to a sofer. No sofer is writing a receipt, benishmashot, on Friday afternoon. So then the creditor is out, the debtor goes away, and then he says, "I had the money then, it's gone now." So what he wants to be is prepared for when the debtor shows up. So he writes in his own handwriting. He doesn't wait to document it when the guy comes, even though he knows how to write it. If I don't give it to him right away, he's not going to give me the money. I'm going to write it and keep it on file so that when the debtor shows up, I have it ready and handy to give to him. It's not our Mishnah. This seems to undermine what we just saw from Rav Yirmiyah Ba'aba Amarav, which is our Mishnah says, if the Malveh has Simponot in his possession, you do exactly what is said in the Simponot. Wait a minute, didn't you just say now that the Simpon in the hand of the Malveh is meaningless? Over here, you're saying that the Simpon in the hand of the Malveh invalidates the Shtar. Why should that be? So, Kedamar of Safra, Shenimtza ben Shtarot Kruim. It's like what Rav Safra says, that it's found amongst his ripped up documents, or the other version is pruim, his paid documents. So he has a pile of documents that are ripped up. Not that this shtar, as Rashi says, is ripped up. This shtar was ripped up, it'd be obvious that this shtar has no validity because it was ripped up. Why is it ripped up? Because it was already paid. But amongst his ripped up shtarot, is this shtar a whole or full shtar that is found? Or, amongst his paid shtarot, he finds this shtar. He's uncertain as to whether it was paid back or not. The fact that it's found in that pile with the shtarot that are ripped up or with the shtarot that are already paid is circumstantial evidence that that shtar was already paid. Therefore, together with the simpon, we're going to say follow whatever's in the simpon because there's overwhelming evidence that this shtar was already paid. Now, it says here, Kedama Rav Safra, like Rav Safra says. The Gemara is going to do this a number of times until it finally gets to the case where Rav Safra actually said this. But it's going to apply this din of Rav Safra to a number of cases. Rashi over here brings two interpretations about Ben Shtarotav Kruim. It says, V'hu eino krua, lefikach somchim ala shuver, shemakom ashtar mochiach ala shuver shu emet. That's the first way, and that's the what I just explained to you. And Rashi says, kach shamati. That's the mesorah that I heard about explaining this. V'li nira. He says, I have a different view of what this is. Shenimsa shuver ben ashtarot akruim. That the receipt was found amongst the ripped up shtarot. Hilkach echa the meimar dinitkabel achov, vashuve ze inzerich the malve haze elalove, vallove shachach biadze. The receipt is not needed by the malve anymore, it's needed by the love. Vikach not no ima shtarot inzerichim lo. Therefore he put it in the pile of discarded shtarot, the shtarot he doesn't need anymore. You understand that the receipt he needs, as we said before, to give to the debtor when he shows up. So if he needs it when the debtor shows up, he keeps that in his active pile because he wants it ready and available when the debtor shows up to give it to him. If the loan's already been repaid and he finds it in the inactive pile, the ripped up shtar pile, or he finds it in the pile of paid contracts, that's because he no longer needs the receipt. He already got the money. He doesn't need the receipt. The debtor didn't ask for the receipt. He forgot to ask for it. He left it with him. So he threw it into the discard pile because he doesn't need it anymore. The fact that the receipt is found in the discard pile is evidence of the fact that it's no longer needed. If it's no longer needed, that means that the document was paid back. So that's Rashi's own explanation versus the way that I explained it is the one that he had been Misora. The explanation of what it means is found amongst the pile of paid contracts. According to the Misora that he had, it was talking about the contract itself. According to Rashi, it's talking about the receipt that is found in that pile. All right, so now Gemara says, Hachanami, Shmatzu ben shtarot kruim. Just like Rav Safra says it over there, he says it here. Tashma, nimtza le'echad ben shtarotav, shtaro sheyoshev ben simon. Parua. Say, Mishnah in Bava Batra, that he finds amongst his shtarot a document that says that the outstanding debt of Yosef ben Shimon has already been paid. Shtarot shteyem pruim. If there are two individuals in the city that have that same name, both of their documents are considered to be paid. Meaning that if he's a creditor to two Yosef ben Shimons in the city, then if he has a receipt that says Yosef ben Shimon Shtar is paid, they both can claim that that was their receipt. And he has no longer has a right of collection from either of these two parties over here. The Gemara in Baba Batra asks, how could he do that? You're not allowed to lend to someone if there's another person with their name in the city because of these problems. You'll never be able to collect from them because each one of them will deny it or say it was the other party. So the Gemara there says that the loan was done with three generations of names. So there was a differentiation in the credit document. It said Yosef ben Shimon ben Avraham, and then there was a Yosef ben Shimon ben Yitzchak. But the Shover, the receipt only says in it Yosef ben Shimon, only has two generations in it. So the problem is, who does the receipt belong to? The documents were documented properly and identified who owed the money. The problem is that the receipt doesn't identify which of the two Yosef ben Shimons. That means that we consider it paid for both of them. But once again, you see that a receipt in the hand of the malve is valid. So why is that? Kedama Rav Safsa, Shnimsa ben Shterot Kurim, Achanami Shnimsa ben Shterot Kurim. Again, like Rav Safsa says, it's found amongst his paid or ripped up contracts. So too over here. Another case, Tashma. Shvoa shlo pekadnu abba, v'shlo amar lanu abba, v'shlo matzanu ben shtarotov shel abba, sh'shtar ze parua. Says a Mishnah in Shvuot with regards to Yitomim. Yitomim of the creditor who want to collect from Yitomim of the debtor. In order to collect from debtor's Yitomim, you have to take a Shvuah. The problem is here that the children of the creditor can't take the normal Shvuah over here because they don't have the information. So what they do is they take a Shvuah that says that we don't have the information. What is that? Shvuah shalom pekadnu abba. Shvuah that we were never instructed by our father that this was paid. Or that our father on his deathbed did not say that this was already paid, meaning that it was a tzavat shemera. Others say shvash lo begadnu abba means that we didn't get any evidence or instructions from other people that it was already paid. Vishlo amar lenu abba, our father never told us that this was already a paid document. And we didn't find it amongst the shtarot that it was already parua. Again, what does that mean? They found it amongst his paid documents. It means that there was a receipt. So lo matzano shover ben shtarotav. We didn't find any receipt amongst his shtarot that it was paid. So again, there we ask the question, why is the shover in the hand of the malva meaningful? And the answer again is, this is Rav Safa's original statement, that it's found amongst his shtarot akruim or pruim. And now tashma. Simpon sheish alav edim. You have a receipt that is signed by edim. Itkayem bechutmav. You are mikayim it through those that signed on it. The Gemara says, if that's the case, you see here that the simpon can be valid in the hands of the malveh. So why again is it valid here in the hands of the malveh? It says, ema yitkayim michotamav. Don't say that yitkayim bichotamav. The fact that it has signatories to the receipt automatically makes it valid. That's not the case. But rather it means yitkayim michotamav. You will then check out whether this was a validated document. The Shalin and Lo'ol Asadei Iparu Alu Iparua. What does it mean that Itkayim Bechotamav? He said, we asked the Edim, was it paid or was it not paid? Then Rashi explains over here, Im Achotamav Me'edim Shechatmua, if we find the Edim and they say they signed it, Ein Amalve Ne'eman. The Malve is not believed to say I never got paid. Aval Kama Delo Mikayim, as long as we don't get the Edim to testify to that fact, Mehemin, he is believed, Taman Mepik Le'i Malve. Who brought us the receipt? It's the malve. Umalve hamar pasuhu. And the malve says it's not a valid receipt. So it's a pesh asu, a pesh hitir, basically, which is that he brought us the receipt that says the thing was paid, but he tells us it's invalid because it was not given to the love yet, and it's invalid. Therefore, just because the fact that it's signed is not enough. You need to have it be mikuyam, which is we find the edim who signed it and say whether the loan actually took place or not, or the loan was repaid or not. Until they testify to that fact, the malve is ne'eman. But once they testify that fact, then the malveh has nothing to stand on. We have witnesses telling us that the loan was repaid. Of course, at that point, the simpon has meaning because we have witnesses to the fact that the loan was repaid. So that's not a standard case of simpon where you find the simpon in the malveh. That Rabbi Yirmiyahu Baba says it's not valid. It doesn't have any meaning. But if you find it with Edim signed it, then you check out with the Edim what the story is. At that point, then the Edim are ne'aman, and whatever they say goes. Tashma. Simpon sheish alav edim, kasher. Simpon that has edim on it is considered to be kasher. So that makes it sound like as long as you have a signed simpon, it's kasher. And again, a simpon is when it's in the hands of the malveh. So now, man, you have a simpon in the hands of the malveh, and we're saying that it's a valid document as long as it's just signed by edim. Again, that goes against Rabbi Amri Abba, where it says, my edim, edei kiyum. What I mean, edim here doesn't mean edim that are signed in the simpon, but rather, that edim kiyum, which means that it was a hempek, it was validated in Beit Din. Of course, if it's validated in Beit Din, then the repayment happened. Otherwise, Beit Din wouldn't validate the shover, the receipt. Hakanami mistavda, Tani Seifa. That makes sense because the latter half of this brayta says, v'shein alav edim pasul. If it doesn't have edim, then it's pasul. My ain't alav edim. What does it mean that it doesn't have edim? Ilema deleki lave edim klau. If you say that the first or the ratio means that it was signed, and the safer means there's no edim on it at all, tzricha lemeimer the pasul? You need me to tell me that it's pasul? Why is a receipt without any edim signed to it have any validity at all? Because it's not signed. So now, the malveh is the one bringing it to us. There's no signatories to the shover. Why should we think that this receipt means that it was paid? El alav edei kiyum. It must mean, what does it mean? That there are edim on the simpon, they're just not edei kiyum. It was not mikuyam in Beit Din. So there are edim signed on it, but there are not edei kiyum, or it wasn't validated in Beit Din. And for that reason, it's not valid, and that would support Rabbi Yirmiyahu Abba's contention that a receipt is not automatically considered to be valid when you find it in the hands of the malveh. It's in the hands of the malveh, you have to suspect that he wrote it in order to use in the future, and he didn't really have it because the loan was repaid. Except with the exceptions to the cases that we mentioned until now, which is it's found in the pile of paid documents, it's found in the ripped up documents, or it's a case where there are edei kiyum on it. Those are reasons to believe that in the hands of the malveh, it's still a valid receipt. But otherwise, we would believe that it's not a valid receipt, even if there are signatories to the receipt itself. All right, Gemara says, Gufa. Simpon sheish alav edim itkayim b'chotamav. Ein alav edim v'yotzei mitachat yidei shlish. Comes out of the hand of a third party. O sheyotzei la'acher chitum shtarot kasher. Or it comes after the signatories to the shtar, then it's kasher. So now, we have different cases here. If you have simpon sheish lav edim, itkayim b'chotamav, you have to validate it with its signatories, or in essence, validate it whether it was paid or not. Ein alav edim, if it doesn't have edim, then it's not valid because of the fact that it was not mikuyam in Beit Din. Since it wasn't mikuyam in Beit Din, we have no evidence of the fact that it was actually utilized or the repayment loan was repaid. Again, just because edim are signed on it doesn't mean that it was actually repaid, it just means that it's ready to go. If it comes out of the hand of a third party, or it comes after a document that evidenced the loan, the reason that if it comes out of the hand of a third party, it's automatically valid is because the malveh trusted the third party. The only person here who can say that it's invalid is the malveh. The malveh, by giving it over to an escrow or to a third party, basically says, if the third party says it's not repaid, it's not repaid. He trusted that individual, he gave it to that individual. Therefore, if the shlish shows up with it, it's considered to be a valid receipt because the malveh empowered the shlish to make that claim. If it comes after the chitum shtar, meaning that here's the document that evidences the loan, and at the bottom, after the signatories to the loan, they have a receipt that is written there that says this is paid, or it's stamped paid at the bottom. So then, that also, if he wouldn't do that in advance of the debtor giving him the money, because that's too risky. He needs that document to make the claim against the debtor. He's not going to preemptively put a receipt on there, because that ruins the shtar. He knows that's going to undermine his ability to collect. The fact that it's written there is evidence of the fact that it definitely happened, because the malveh would never let them ruin the shtar to preemptively create a receipt, because of the risk that the guy never pays him, and now he doesn't even have a valid shtar to go after. So in those two cases, the receipt is considered to be a valid receipt, because the malveh either would not let it happen, or he entrusted the other party, and by entrusting the other party, he gave him the rights to make the claim. So in that case, the receipt is considered to be a valid receipt. So either you need a shlish on the shtar itself, or the validation of the edim on the receipt. All of those would make the receipt a valid receipt, and the malveh would not be able to collect. On the other hand, again, if it's in the hands of the loveh, then it is protected. If the loveh is holding it, that's where the shover should be. And if he has it, then he doesn't have to pay. He has a receipt in hand. Okay, with that we complete the first parak, Shnayim Ochzim, Hadran Alach, Shnayim Ochzim.